I'm going to ask you to give us some comments, please, just by way of introduction, on the role that you are playing in your business to develop a kind of momentum around behavioral economics, behavioral finance, phenology. So give us a quick little window into what is it you do?
Well, I'm very much interested in behavioral sciences broadly. And because my background is in, you know, financial services, I'm obviously interested in that, where we see an overlap between the financial services and the behavioral sciences in general. And also because of that background, I have an opportunity to speak to other financial services practitioners in a way, using a vocabulary and a language that we can share. And so we are essentially part of the same community. So what I try to do within our group is to look at, we do meta science. So we're looking at all of the research in a given area in behavioral sciences, and we try and distill this down into concrete, actionable insights, which you can then subsequently share with practitioners. Now, this goes a huge range from asset pricing to thinking about complex decision making, leadership, and even more recently, we've done some work on diversity and inclusion. So the behavioral obstacles to progress on diversity and inclusion is also part of the area that we're working on. But concentrating on very specific areas, looking at where there is a behavioral component or where behavior plays an important role, and looking at what we can do practically, actionably, in order to help those people we are assisting.
Okay, so thank you, Herman. So that gives you a construct for Herman's involvement here. Thank you for joining us and coming across for this workshop tomorrow. Mary, you started the program today. Take a moment, if you would, please, to give a bridge between what it is that you've seen and observed and listened to in what we're grappling with here, and how you observe other groups of people grappling with the same issues. Are there any similarities between what we're dealing with and the groups with whom you're working?
Oh, that's interesting. Well, yes, I speak to lots of different kinds of groups, mostly business folks, but also healthcare, the business of healthcare, legal profession, sometimes regulators, the military, et cetera. And what always interests me is the number of people who will come up to me afterwards and will talk about their own personal challenges and will find the approach that I'm talking about quite appealing because it gives a sense of hope or a sense of possibility. What I find so often is that when I talk to people about the stories of times when they've encountered various kinds of values challenges in their professions, and they tell me stories of times when they have effectively acted on their values, and then they always want to tell me the times when they did not. And when I ask them why they didn't, it's almost always because they say they didn't think they had the choice. And that is something that I also heard here today. And so I think that's a very important theme. And I think what's great about what you're doing with phenology is you're helping people understand, not just in an inspirational way, but in a pragmatic and practical way, how to use what we know about how people think and act to allow them to feel that they have more choices. And then the one other thing I'll say is that almost everyone who came up to me to talk to me on breaks and stuff talked about the political situation in the United States. So that was sort of interesting. Sad, but interesting.
Okay, well, we'll take from that there's a degree of affinity with the perspectives you shared, perhaps. Pat, I'd like to turn to you, and you're kind of out of being deeply involved in the financial services space per se, the investment advice space per se. Give us some context for, though, the financial services benchmarking types of programs you've been involved with, and how they would compare with the types of things that we're now developing with the FBI. What is benchmarking and how all that fits together? Take a couple of minutes on that.
Sure. Well, so I spent maybe 15 years or so of my career at a company called CEB, as I mentioned before, and the kinds of studies that we did there were these sorts of benchmarking and best practice studies that essentially took a community of like, in that case it was chief marketing officers, like-minded or like-positioned executives, and we sought to help them learn from each other and benchmark against themselves, the better to kind of accelerate the adoption of best practice across the community and accelerate learning across the community. And so I think what we're doing with FBI, and you know, we did this a bit with a prior study that Rob and I worked on around the state of client understanding, which is also focused on the advice space. But the FBI, we're taking this deep dive into, as I mentioned, this sort of ethereal, you know, stuff of phonology that is, it's the water that we swim in terms of the way that we think and how that influences what we say and what we do and how we interact with clients and how they interact with us and so on. And so, you know, this is a bit different than what we've done in the past in that we're taking a look at some things that, as I was mentioning, you know, are a little bit intangible and hard to pin down and get the mechanics of and really put shape to, but we think with the instruments we've developed, we'll be able to start to do that. And, you know, are we ever going to have the perfect view of the way that phonology works? Probably not, but I think we can do a heck of a lot better than where we sit today, which is sort of, we've got the academic research that does a really good job of pointing out that these sorts of biases and so on exist, but let's take it into the financial advice context specifically and help folks appreciate for themselves their self-awareness, as Rob was saying, how to detect this stuff in their clients, and then what do they do in, you know, in the moment? I wonder, you know, Mary's work makes me wonder if there's muscle memory here that could be developed through practice and the like, that's sort of taking that idea and applying it to what we've been talking about here.
Thank you.
Yeah.
Tassos, you gave some comments about India. What's your fascination with India? And are there other countries that you've spent time in? And as part of answering that question, I'd like you to just give us a little more tangibility to, you know, what is this research type stuff doing in terms of translating from, you know, you showed a picture of meeting the young lady. Now, how does that translate into investment outcomes?
Okay. So I have done 23 ethnographic studies. I've covered 15 countries from South Africa, Nigeria, Ghana, Brazil, Chile, Peru, Colombia, Mexico, Indonesia, Thailand, Philippines, Vietnam. I've done 5 studies through China. I've done 8 through India. And my fascination with India is that India is not one country now, but is actually becoming 2 countries. Mm. And that is creating humongous investment opportunities. And I will refer to this as India 1 and India 2. India 1 is basically the India that you know from the brokers you meet. These are the guys who studied abroad. They are fed on their daily dosage of Netflix. They want the international brands. They basically, when you look at the millennials, they're exactly like the millennials you hear about in the developed world, the millennials who we hear with every generation, with more freedom that you're giving them, the more they focus on themselves. But actually, there is a second India that is being formed. And we call this India 2, or we refer to these people as modern nationals. And they are forming a very different value set. Instead of going to the path of individualism in their values, how we normally progress in the developed world, what we're seeing from these individuals is a shift back to more collective values. And they see that the changes that have taken place in the developed world in generations are happening too fast for them. They're happening in a matter of years. So they're kind of saying, yes, I want a smartphone, I want this technology, but I don't want to give up my roots and my heritage. And what is happening is a more collective form of consumption. So whereas when you meet Chinese, they will leave their parents back in the village and not care about them. These guys want holidays together for the whole family. They want to buy insurance products for their parents. So as a result, when I look at this, I actually, in India, I don't have one pyramid with all these international products, the iPhones that everybody thinks you will buy, and you have all these humongous, this bottom, the next billion that's going to rise up and go in that pyramid. But I actually have two pyramids. And this pyramid is very under-researched and not very well understood, because these guys do not live in the major cities of Mumbai. When you interview them, they tell you, Mumbai is taking, the big cities, is taking more away from me than it's giving me. I want to be close to my roots, to my heritage. And what I find, I talked very briefly, and some people asked me about a crisis we are having in terms of the male gender identity. And what is fascinating about these young guys, the millennials, I find that because they're going back to their roots, they're very much more grounded because they can look into their religion and come up with a better moral path that they can follow. You ask them what it takes to succeed, and they will tell you, I follow this religious person who says that all I have to do is work hard and have patience and perseverance. So that's my motto. This is the work I'm going to follow. So we look at this second pyramid, and what you realize, Graham, is that it's creating opportunities that we would normally miss. For example, these guys are...
Translate quickly into what does this mean from an investment
perspective? You look for... Think of this woman I told you today. She's creating products that are natural. So look for natural products at a much lower price point. The multinational cannot do that. The multinational has to upsell you to that organic. Look for local brands that are great value for money brands, having authenticity, integrity, honesty in the brand, and look for those brands and invest in them.
Okay. Dan, now you've heard all that stuff from this group of people. Tassos, the only other investor in the group, but focused more narrowly in a sense than a solutions group. How are you drawing all this stuff together in the way you're thinking about investment and portfolio solutions? How do you keep on top of all the kinds of things that you're hearing here from a behavioral type of perspective?
Well, I think the as I said before, the challenge and the opportunity, this is the nexus of all of that. And how people think about managing this in themselves and their clients and their portfolios has been an area that we constantly are looking at, whether that be engaging with academics or reading the research or talking to folks like these, right, to say, you know, what's out there in the marketplace, how are people thinking about their portfolios and dealing with these behavioral biases issues. But I think that needs to be connected to, you know, going from the general to the specific and say, all right, what bias do I want to take advantage of? How can I put a process in place that's going to be able to look at the same points of data every day, that's trying to take advantage of that, and tell me when things start to deviate? Because the reality is that you know, these are long-term issues that investors have to kind of grapple with. It doesn't mean every single day there's wild divergence that you can try to arbitrage away. So from my perspective, it's understanding that these will move in time, but to put in place the system or the process or the model or whatever word you want to put on it in a way that allows you to be disciplined how you look at it. Because if you think factors 1, 2, and 3 are the important ones, look at 1, 2, and 3 every day, because it's so easy to fall into these traps ourselves. And so I think that from my perspective, you know, there's a lot of interesting work that continues to come out on it. It's evolving. The fact that we as an industry are moving away from it's all about the numbers into all of these points, I think is actually a healthy decision, because it's the humans that create the mispricing. It's the humans that create the opportunity. We want to be able to go after it.
Okay, so there's an introduction set from each of those on the panel. They represent the content that you've heard during today. Now opportunity for microphone, questions, comment, You're welcome to stand up and give an opinion if you wish. Comment or contrast or question.
This is a question for Dan. Dan, you touched on this 3-year past performance issue, mm-hmm. and that seems to be all pervasive in the industry, and most academic work suggests that's not a particularly good thing to be doing. Mm-hmm. Is it? What is it? Is it one bias, or is it a series of biases that add up to that type of behaviour? Is there anything we can do as an industry, or are we going to talk about this in 5 years' time at Graham's Forum?
Yeah. Well, I think it's an interesting question because we probably have been talking about it for 10 years' time, right? This is, as you say, it's not a new point. Listen, I think that there's a variety of issues that come into it, and it is probably a number of different biases. I think a big part of it is, you know, there's a desire to help people invest and hit their long-term objectives, and I don't think anybody walks into this saying, you know what, forget that, I want to just be about the next 1 year, right? But the reality is that you know, these are businesses for all of us, right? And there's businesses upon businesses that support all of us. And I think that that starts to snowball. And so the loss aversion we talked about, I spoke about in an investment context, I'd say we have that loss aversion in a business context. I don't want to lose that client. If this manager underperformed in 18 months, right, I got to move on that quickly because I don't want them to move on me. And I think that unfortunately has created a very vicious circle. That gets us in that point. And so I think it goes a little bit back to that point about the false comfort we have in the things that we benchmark against. And in an industry that manages everything versus a benchmark, right, and not focusing enough on the outcomes is critical. And so the more we can be doing to invest and find strategies that focus on the outcome is I think, is where we got to go. But I think it's because of we're worried about our own business risk in the meantime.
For the FBI, is there any moves to take this benchmarking to UK, to Canada, to the United States to see how Australasia compares with those other markets for phenology?
Sure. I'll give you a quick comment on that. The way the benchmarking program has been framed up is to be able to be internationalized, and so it kind of depends on the momentum that we can gain to establish a base framework, but it certainly lends itself to internationalisation, yes.
Hi, this is for Mary. I found your presentation brilliant this morning.
Thanks.
In my view, I would hope that the Royal Commission would give advisors the confidence to maybe challenge their superior with, you know, maybe if they're being asked to do something they don't feel comfortable with. In your experience, do you think that will eventuate, or do you think it'll have no impact?
Whether the Royal Commission will have impact or... Yeah. I think it depends on... It's not a matter of just setting some guidelines or some objectives or some advice. I think that probably won't have much impact. What I think really has to happen is that people have to be enabled to be able to do that. I've spent some time here in Australia speaking with people who are working with the folks who are designing some of those new guidelines to talk about how they need to build in the kind of rehearsal, the kind of prescripting, the kind of practice-based scenarios that help people build that confidence and that competence to do this. You're building a different kind of conversation in organizations. There's an assumption that you can't raise those sorts of issues. In fact, we're in the workshop tomorrow, we're going to actually use a couple scenarios, and one of them is specifically what you're talking about. And there's a belief, I've seen this, I started out seeing this early in my career with MBA students at Harvard, but I've seen it out in actual practice as well, where people assume that they'll be killed. You know, they'll assume that they can't do this sort of thing. And just setting guidelines or advice or best practice, it's a good thing, don't get me wrong, but it's definitely not enough.
I have a question about Paris's suggestion that we work out what the value sets of our fund managers are. I like the idea because I'm pretty sure I do it intuitively, but I'm just interested in anybody on the panel's comment on how much weight you think you would give that when you're assessing a fund manager for inclusion or exclusion in their portfolio based on their value sets.
Okay, so question for the panel. I think be interesting to throw to you in the first instance, Herman. Assessing values of managers, what's your comment?
When you ask the question, you know, what makes community, the first thing that popped into my mind, shared values. I was going to put my hand up, but that was, of course, the answer. Because when it comes to the relationship you have with a fund manager or anybody for that matter, the thing that unites you the most strongly is going to be your shared values. And your whole trust relationship is going to sit on those shared values. Now, you can take a, you know, a much more abstract, distanced perspective and say, well, look, I just want to have a look at the numbers. That's all that bothers me. But what will happen is that when those numbers start to be a little bit disappointing, then that manager will just basically be cut, and you won't want to even want to hear what's on the other side of the discussion, what those thoughts are, what that manager is really ready to share with you and to be vulnerable to you. When you have shared values, however, you have the possibility, firstly, to tell the manager what it is that you genuinely want. What is it that the client genuinely wants? And it's not just about performance, the number at the end of the day. That's not all the client wants in the end. There's a lot more behind this. And to be able to tell the other person what it is that you really want is going to be based on that relationship. And for them to be able to tell you what they can genuinely do for you is also going to be based on that relationship. So the essence of the relationship and the trust that exists between you and that other person is going to be based on those shared values. And it's going to be very important then if you're going to have a successful conclusion in the end, or you're going to have a relationship which is going to be interrupted at the first negative number that comes down the line. I find it be absolutely essential.
So Dan and then Tassos, and then I'd like to invite whether Pat and Mary have a comment from kind of outside of the direct financial sector. So Dan, Tassos, an observation?
I think the observation that just sort of hit me about 10 seconds ago was this actually probably ties back to the first question about time horizon, right? Because to the extent that a relationship with a manager is simply transactional, I'm buying a return stream, and that may be appropriate in some cases, right? But if you really want core partners in your portfolio, it's so much more than just what's your 1-3-5. And I do wonder, and I'm thinking back to the first question around time horizon, is the extent that we actually can get back to a world that is actually true relationships, right? Which means there's going to be periods where you've got to buck up when a manager underperforms for 2, 3, 4 years, but they're going to be lined up with the way that you want to go. I think that that's an area that is not talked about enough. I think that, you know, I found in my experience that when you have those types of, you know, manager-client relationship turns into a much stronger thing. Now, you're not going to agree on everything. It's not going to be kumbaya all the time. But I do think that that overlap is important for partnership.
But you're in an interesting position because in a solutions context, you're including asset managers, fund managers that aren't necessarily part of your home shop. So do you approach values symmetry in the way you're looking at including capabilities inside the portfolios
I mean, to be frank, I'm not sure we label it as values per se like this, but I think it is very much a question to say, you know, we're looking for roles to happen in the portfolio. We need to trust that they're going to deliver on that. And so understanding what they do, how they do, what their organization's like, those are the things that we do want to dig into. And so things like culture, which I would argue is part of the values conversation, is critically important to us. You know, let's face it, there will be times I want to buy a return stream, right? And there are vehicles and products out there for me to do that quickly and easily. But that's not the core kind of building blocks, the long-term building blocks we want to have. We're going to look at these deeper questions that are going to ask kind of the conversation we're having right now.
And sometimes would it be also true, Herman, that you could have shared values but equally get to a point where you want a divorce? Because you've still got shared values, but the performance numbers just aren't there. Mm-hmm. Is that a fair comment?
Yes, absolutely. You can still have shared values and say, well, this is not working for us. Or what you can deliver is not necessarily what I want. And both sides will certainly be in a position to see that.
If I could just tag on to that, I think that there's also the reason you get divorced is that maybe what I do isn't what you need right now. Right, and there's an opportunity then to maybe break up, and who knows, maybe you start dating again in the future, right? But that I think is part of what partnership looks like, in the sense of there's a time and a place, and to be willing to kind of go both ways.
Yeah, that's what I would also add, that for a good advisor to be able to say, you know, what it is that you want, I'm not the best person to be able to deliver this to you. I'm going to recommend you go and consult with somebody else because they can give you a better service than I would be able to do. That is a reflection of my values towards you. And part of our shared values is that understanding. So I'm not the one who's going to deliver, although we share the same values.
Tassos, comment?
For me, I think it's at the core of everything. And I'll tell you a simple story. When we launched, we had one client, and 3 months after we launched, a big US institution, $20 billion, called us up. They did multiple due diligences, and they said to me, you need to speak to our boss before we put you through the investment committee. So I sat with my whole team, and we got on the conference call, and I went to start to explain this research we do, and he said to me, I don't want to hear about your research. I want to know why you own Tencent. I said, but I have to explain to you the background. And he said to me, no, I just want to understand why you think you have an edge on this stock. And I turned on the call and I said, you know, it's a two-way process. You're selecting your manager, and we have a boutique, and we want to select the clients we want to work with, and I don't think this is going to work out. And I look at my team, and they went white, and their mouth dropped, and we finished it. And we do a lot of work on our values, and Andy, who is the compliance officer, turned around and said to me, you violated one of our values. One of our values is empathy, and you showed no empathy. You behaved like a complete jerk to this guy. And I turned and said, yes, it's true. Empathy is our value number 7, because what defines you as an individual there is how you prioritize values. And our number 3 value is a sense of learning new things. We call it learning journey. And if I allow this individual to waste another 55 minutes of 4 individuals around the table, I take you away from our work. We're here to learn. And therefore, I did not violate the value. I protected it. And we have to remember that, and we talk about it, and Mary touched on it, and I think it's quite important. Values will get violated. And when the value gets violated, 2 things are going to happen. If you're more powerful than the other person, you're going to blow up at them. But if it's your boss, like you asked before, you're going to suffocate. And you're going to sit there, and you're going to be depressed. And you're going to take it home, and it's going to eat you inside. And happiness at the end of the day is when you manage to bring these values together. So for me, I stay away from competitive people. I don't like people who care only about performance. And you can understand who cares. When I went to this trip to India, I sent to Graham what I'm thinking about. And people send me back ideas. And then I know which clients really engage and believe in this research. And these guys are the guys I want to be my clients. And together, we are building what you said before, which is critical, a community, which is not only share values, but also shared goals.
Okay. Thank you, gentlemen. Now, Pat, a quick comment from a kind of marketing perspective on how you would turn what's just been discussed into, if you like, messaging, into how you would deal with that from a marketing perspective. What's going through your head,
Yeah. Even
though you're not in the investment space per se?
Yeah.
Then we'll go to you, please, Mary.
Yeah, this is a fascinating conversation because in a lot of ways it comes down to differentiating and branding commodities. So, you know, my specialty is in working with CMOs and studying marketing. And business-to-consumer marketers, brand marketers, have been over this notion of living shared values in their brands for 20 to 30 years. And that sort of happened through the fierceness of market competition that's led them there, because they've discovered that if their brands can credibly demonstrate that they share a set of higher order values with their consumers, then it translates into loyalty and a whole bunch of other nice things, you know, word of mouth and so on and so forth. So, you know, in the branding space, if you look at the history of the way that brands developed, and this is like branding sand, right? A lot of what these guys are selling, it's sand. It's very substitutable at the core of it. I'll leave you guys to make your own judgment about money and how substitutable that is. But, you know, so these guys all started with functional benefits. You know, I think of OxyClean in the U.S., which, you know, Daniel, appreciate this, but, you know, the way that OxyClean went to market and continues to go to market is there's a big loud guy who gets on TV and he screams at you about just how clean this detergent is going to make your clothes. And, you know, so that's sort of the base level. Next, B2C marketers kind of discover this notion of really playing up emotional benefits. Oh, it's not just that it makes your clothes clean. What's the benefit that you get by having cleaner clothes? Oh, I can better get a date, right? Maybe that's too autobiographical. But, you know, what's the emotional benefit that you get? And then, you know, beyond that, you get to this shared value level. These are higher order values. And, you know, Unilever, I'd give credit to Unilever, who's been on this notion for 20-some years, and that their brand's credibly demonstrating that they share a value, higher order value, with their consumers. But the key, I think, is, in executing this, is they have to walk the walk. So they have to be willing to take some pain to actually show that they live those values, because it's very easy these days to greenwash that sort of thing and to say you stand for that, but when you really scratch below the surface, it's very quickly evident that you don't. So to me, that's kind of where my mind goes on this, and, you know, I'll leave you guys to sort of take that back into the advice and the investment management context, but those are some of the parallels I see. I would love to see some fund managers really push hard into this shared values space, because to me, it seems like a great fertile ground for differentiation.
Mary, some comments.
I started thinking about it from my perspective as a consumer. I mean, I have a financial advisor who I've worked with for decades and have a very strong and positive relationship with, after going through a series of very unsatisfying relationships with different investment advisors. And there were a few things that I thought of that I think have been the core of that relationship, and they all get back to the shared value idea. One of them is that I worked with him. We were both on the board of directors of a nonprofit. I was president of the board, and he was the finance manager. And I saw how he managed the finances of the organization with incredible smarts. And he found all kinds of ways for us to do better, and yet with impeccable honesty. And it was just such a nice combination. So a minute ago, I think Graham asked the question about, you know, what if you have shared values? Do you always stick with the person? And to me, that reminded me of the question that always gets asked in my work, which is, do companies that perform ethically do better financially? In other words, can ethics pay? And there have been, you know, hundreds of academics who've done studies on this, and there have been meta studies on why the studies aren't useful, et cetera, et cetera. But, you know, I always feel that it's really the wrong question. You know, there are ethical companies and managers who do well, and there are ethical companies and managers who do not do well. And there are unethical managers and companies that do well, at least for a time, and there are those that do not. And I think we think somehow that if you're going to bother to be ethical, then you should be assured of success. You still have to be competent. You still have to be clever. You still have to be resourceful. You still have to have some luck. And so that's kind of how I think about that question. But when I think back to my own financial advisor, you know, I went to him because I had that trust, having seen him in operation. And throughout the years we've worked together, there have been a number of tests. So, for example, he's worked for major corporations, major organizations. He's not an independent. And in several of the organizations he's worked with, they've dealt with major scandals. And in each case, we had a sort of come-to-Jesus conversation where I talked about my own experience with him and what the pressures were on him and to what extent this was affecting or not affecting me. And I felt very confident that he was being very honest with me about that. And so it enabled me to be able to look beyond his organizational context to his performance for me. And his relationship with me. I always felt that he was trying to solve my problems, and I sometimes would come in with a problem and a solution I had in mind, and he was very good at helping me figure out when my solution, coming from less sophistication around investment management than he had, was probably not going to be that effective, but was able to still solve my problem in a different way. So he was able to frame it in that way. And then the last thing I'll mention is that he is now at the point where he is, in the next year or two, he's going to be moving out, retiring. And so he has started intentionally bringing along another colleague who he's worked with for a while and is bringing him to our meetings and is really actively managing the succession, which makes me feel, again, this sense of trust and that he's really taking care of my financial future. So, you know, those are a few things that I think are all based on shared values of mutual respect. Also, the other thing I'd say is he's been a fantastic teacher, and I really, really value that. So when I come with him with questions and issues, he's willing to take the time to teach me so I can be a more informed investor. So those are some of the values that have been very important to me.
Okay, thank you. I'm going to ask one question further in this space to just kind of round it out, and I'd really appreciate just a real quick comment for one or two of you if it fits with your knowledge. If a community or fund manager selection based on one of the audience questions, so it's the one we've just been dealing with, is based on shared values, wouldn't that potentially enhance the occurrence of bias, sort of embedding shared bias? How would you like to respond to that quickly, Herman?
Yes, this is the short answer.
Yes, you want to answer the question?
Yes, it would. There's a possibility that would it enhance the biases. Namely, that if you, those shared values could lead you to looking from the same perspective at a given problem and coming up with a solution that both of you, you know, find agreeable. And as a result, even if things are going in the wrong direction, both of you stick tenaciously to that point of view, that perspective, that solution, without looking for alternatives. But the solution to this is not to abandon shared values. It has to be the process. So you need to have a process in place. I mean, even the word bias, I don't particularly like it, you know, because it almost suggests that we're doing something wrong. Yeah. But the reality, what we're talking about are preferences. So we have preferences which are useful in a vast number of contexts, but in other contexts, exactly the same preferences are not particularly useful. And as a result, we cannot switch on these preferences on and off because we are, you know, doing one kind of activity and doing a different kind of activity. We're going to have them all of the time. So what we have to do is to make sure that in a given context where we've discovered that those preferences are not particularly useful, that we put in place some processes that will protect us from the negative consequences of those preferences. And that is the solution to those bias problems. It's not to abandon shared values.
Okay, so half a second comment. Tassos, anybody else?
Yeah, I mean, for us, we do a lot of work on our values. I've mapped my whole team, and I can tell you, I cannot see a correlation between our biases. We have every bias in the world in our team. But I think Herman is spot on right about the processes. And yesterday, somebody touched on pre-mortems. And somebody asked about challenging your boss. A process like a premortem is a great way, without insulting somebody, to have these challenge conversations. Because you're not throwing stones at somebody's argument. A premortem for us every quarter, for example, even in the business, we will say, okay, here is the, we assume that we are 3 years in the future and you have a major issue in the firm. What has happened? Then it's a very constructive conversation to discuss these issues. without causing problems. And it helps you get over some of these biases. So it's creating these mechanisms that allow you to challenge and overcome some of these biases.
Okay. So I'm going to take one more question from the audience. Pete has a question here. Thank you, Soph. Thank you.
Thanks. Actually, quick comment and also then the question.
Please.
So hearing the discussion around choosing a fund manager, which Kerry had before, and values, it reminds me of an article I read in the AFR in the last week where the journalist was raising the issue of a particular Aussie equity manager that owned a lot of the stock PA. And it just made, I actually made a note in our process to ask fund managers whether they hold stocks PA as well as in the fund, because it creates a conflict. So it's not just advisors who can have conflicts, fund managers can too. But so the question was to Mary, and your conversation today has been about the things people can do if there are ethical issues with their bosses. But what are some things bosses can do to create an ethical, friendly environment where there may be disagreements, but they can be addressed in a constructive way?
It's such an important question. One of the things we talk about with giving voice to values is that companies who come to me and ask me to bring this approach to their employees will usually say, well, come and train our mid-level employees, our lower-level employees. You don't need to worry about the senior-level people because, you know, they wouldn't have gotten to be senior-level if they didn't know how to voice their values, right? But focus on the lower-level folks, right? But then once we get into the organization, people realize, well, maybe we do need to talk to the senior-level people as well. But we've learned that we had to frame it a little bit differently when we were talking to senior-level people, both because their roles are different, and also because of their egos, to be honest. And so we talk about giving voice to values at the senior level, or the more managerial level as opposed to a report, as having three components. So the first component is that they still need to use all the approaches and the tools and the skills and the rehearsal and the pre-scripting we talk about, but they're often needing to do that on scenarios where they need to speak laterally. So rather than talking up to your boss, you may be talking to your other senior peers, the other members of the C-suite, whatever it is, and these are people that you need to, that, well, first of all, they have egos, but you need to create ongoing relationships with them. And when you frame it this way, they're more willing to listen to me because it's not as if I'm talking to them about you need to be able to speak up to your boss, right? They don't like that. It's interesting, when I first raised this issue, I was doing some work with McKinsey, and they had asked me to come in and train the senior level partners who were considered the internal McKinsey faculty, and they would do all the leadership development for the internal McKinsey folks. And they would meet, the global group would meet, there were about 80 of them every couple of years. And they were meeting in Berlin, and they had me come in to share GVV with them. And we gave them, we shared the approach, and then I gave them some scenarios. And when they came back to debrief, the most senior guy in the room raised his hand to make the first comment, and I called on him, and he said, well, I looked at this scenario, and I thought, well, this is stupid. And I thought, oh, shit, you know, excuse me. I thought, oh, no, what's, you know, what do we do now? And then he paused, and he said, but then I thought about it, and I realized it's not stupid. It was obvious to me what the right thing to do was. That was the part that felt stupid. But then I realized it's really hard for me to tell my other senior partner colleague, because we're all partners, in a way that I can keep working with him, you know, and that I can maintain this relationship. So that's the first level. We frame it as talking laterally. The second level, we talk about you need to create a culture that will support this. But the third level is where we get the most traction, and I think it might be what you're talking to, which is we say the same activities and exercises around rehearsal, practice, pre-scripting also apply to how do you hear it when someone brings this issue to you. And I'll just give you a brief example. You mentioned Unilever earlier. I did some work with Unilever. They asked me to go work with their entire Unilever division in Nigeria. And so, you know, we went in, we did our intelligence gathering, we gathered all the scenarios, and then we went in and did a training, which was supposed to be for a group of change champions who were going to then roll it out throughout the organization, train the trainer. At the last minute, they said, would you mind if we brought all the senior managers for Nigeria into the same meeting?
Now, this is, of course, the holy grail for people who do the kind of work I do. It's also kind of frightening because it could go really wrong. But what was interesting is we shared all the GVV approaches with them. They practiced, and then we gave them scenarios. And we put all the middle managers at their own tables and said, do the usual GVV exercise. How would you raise this values conflict with your manager? We put the senior leaders at their table and said, how could someone bring this to you in a way that would make it easier for you to respond appropriately? So when they came together to do the debrief, this kind of natural social contracting started to happen, where the senior leaders started identifying the behaviors that would make it easier for them to hear and respond. And the middle managers were identifying the behaviors that would make it easier for them to raise the issue effectively. And they ended up deciding, this was not my plan, they decided we're going to create a GVV contract where we're going to agree to play these different roles and raise things. So to answer your question, a lot of it is how you hear it when someone rings the issue to you.
Okay. That's a good way to finish, other than a sentence and a short sentence from each of you, please, starting with Pat, a short sentence on what the key takeout is you'd like to leave our group with that you'll take from this session, perhaps. What's one sentence key takeout, Pat?
From today's session.
From today's session.
How about just know thyself?
Dan.
This stuff is hard. And humans have been wired this way for a long time. And so it takes time, effort, and commitment to get on top of it.
Yeah, they call it soft skills, but it's actually hard skills. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, we have preferences. It's not wrong to have those preferences. But if there are situations where it's unhelpful, only the process is going to save you. Learning about it does not really help.
Wear culture glasses and see the world through these glasses. It will make you a better investor.
Mary?
And as I said before, we often have more choices than we believe we do.